You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Alright, and a couple more. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Wait, should I do one more that's more varied? Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR. Hey, you're listening... Oh, wait, right, ready?
Yeah.
Hey, you're... Sorry. Okay. All right, I'm going to start in 3, 2, 1. Hey, you're listening to A Face for Radio on CITR.
The East Van Go-Go's are pleased to announce a benefit concert and brunch Sunday, November 6th at the Trout Lake Community Center. Proceeds benefit the Grandmothers to Grandmothers Project of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, supporting African grandmothers who are raising children orphaned by AIDS. The event combines delicious home cooking and soul-stirring live performances from Illiterati. Seating is limited, so reserve a ticket now by emailing eastvangogos@gmail.com.
It's the biggest musical competition in the country.
CITR is hosting our 33rd annual Shindig. It's a battle of the bands at Pat's Pub every Tuesday night.
We've curated 27 rad bands to compete for the title.
Who will take the crown from last year's winners late spring? Come to find out. Fun fact, at this year's Shindig, there'll be fun facts for beers.
Thanks to this year's sponsors, AMS Events, Backline Musician Services, Canadian Music Week, Discorder, Fader Master Studios, Rain City Recorders, Mint Records, Music Waste, Nimbus Recording, Thunderbird Radio Hell, Sixcent Press, Silver Fox Postering, Band Merch Canada, Blue Light Studios, Zulu Records, Bernie Brewing, and Print Print.
Come out to Shindig this Tuesday, November 1st, to see the Cut Losses, Jock Tears, and the Magic Circle.
All right, we are back. The show is A Face for Radio. I'm your host, Eric Coates. Welcome. Good morning. How are you? We're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC. It is a dreary, gray, rainy day outside. So luckily for me, I'm inside and get to do this show. And I hope you're somewhere nice and warm listening to it as well. Today, I'm very pleased to announce that we have the first part of a great interview with Molly Ryan and Dan Levinson. Molly Ryan is a jazz vocalist and rhythm guitarist. She is based in New York City. And Dan Levinson is a clarinetist and saxophone player, and also her husband, also based in New York City. And they play traditional jazz from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And it was really great. I met Dan when I was in New York, and he gave me Molly's CD. I was a big fan. And was lucky enough to get them on the phone for an interview. And the interview went pretty well, I think. I was just pleased the whole time listening to their stories and talking about jazz and other things. You know, this is an eclectic show. We really play all sorts of music. But I do have a soft spot for this kind of music. So it was really nice to talk to some people who are real pros in the business and are keeping it alive. So it's great. But the interview ended up going on for a pretty long time. It was, which is great, actually. But it just meant we'd have to split it up over two shows. So today we're going to listen to a couple songs. But the meat and potatoes of the show will be my interview with Molly Ryan and Dan Levinson. But before that, how about we get listening to Molly Ryan? And this is off of her last album called Let's Fly Away, featuring living legend Dick Hyman. The song we're going to play is the title track, Let's Fly Away. And you'll hear it in an interview, but they have a good story about Dick Hyman playing on this song. So I hope you enjoy. After that, we'll get straight to the interview. And that's all for now. Thank you.
Let's fly away. Find a land that's warm and tropic, where inhibitions aren't the topic all the livelong day. Let's fly away. Find a land that's so provincial, we'll never hear what Walter Winchell might be forced to say. I'll make your life sublime far across the blue. I'll take up all your time compromising you. Let's not delay. Make Mother Nature our messiah. New York is not for us. Let's fly away.
That was Molly Ryan with the song Let's Fly Away. It featured Dick Hyman on the piano with a wonderful solo, and they'll talk about that solo in the interview. Dan Levinson's also on the track, helped arrange and produce it. So let's get going to part one of our interview with Molly Ryan and Dan Levinson. This is A Face for Radio. I'm your host, Eric Coates. I hope you enjoy this part one of the interview, and we'll be back with some more chatter and music after that. This is A Face for Radio, and I'm your host, Eric Coates. On the phone for an interview today, I have, all the way from New York City, jazz vocalist and guitarist Molly Ryan, as well as her husband, the clarinetist and sax man, Dan Levinson. How are you, Molly and Dan?
Hey, Eric. We're great.
Hello, Eric.
Doing well.
Had some laryngitis. Other than that, I'm okay.
All right. Well, you guys sound good over the phone. Thank you for coming on the show for an interview. It's a real pleasure to have both of you here. So
thanks for calling us.
Yeah, well, I'll start off with you, Molly. I wanted to ask, just when did you start singing and playing music? And then from that, when and why and how did you decide to become a jazz vocalist and musician in particular?
Well, let's see. I began singing when I was just a wee tot. Really, I was my mom would take me to a speech therapy because I had a lisp, and the speech therapist would coach me to sing a song, and that improved my lisp and helped get rid of that. And then because I was doing so well with the speech therapy and singing and that, I went on to join some choruses, and I never stopped singing. It was right from the very beginning. And as I was growing up, my father would take me to jazz festivals, or the jazz festival in Sacramento, I should say. And he was also friends with Bob Ringwald, who is a jazz pianist out in California. And I fell in love with the old jazz, the 1920s, 30s jazz. And Bob would teach me songs, and I would get a chance to perform them. And that's when I was about 10 or 11 years old. So
wow.
I've basically been doing this a long time now.
That's wonderful. Great. So I guess now that we know how you got started, I want to talk a bit about your latest release, which I've been listening to recently, Let's Fly Away, and it has a definite theme to it, you know, travel in a word. How did you come to this theme? Was it a conscious choice, or did you just notice that you're interested in singing, you know, the standards that happen to be about travel? How did it come about?
No, it was definitely conscious. We both enjoy traveling, and we've done a lot of traveling. And my dad is a pilot, and it's something. Flying has always been a big part of my life, and being able to go to so many different places around the world, it's definitely a perk of being a musician. Is bringing joy to people in all different countries. And I don't know, it started with just a couple songs that I definitely wanted to do. And then I asked Dan for his input on particular songs. And he would say, well, what about this one? Or you have to do this one. And I'd say, oh, yeah, I totally forgot about that one. And then that's a great choice. And before you know it, we had even more options than we needed. And we had to narrow it down to just those 16 that we did.
Great. That's, you also touched on a few points that I actually wanted to talk about. So first of all, the album's great. But second, you talked about that you travel a lot. It's always been a part of your life. You also, I assume, travel a lot playing music, as you mentioned, sorry. Since you play there's the style is sort of traditional, you know, old-timey 1920s, 30s style music, have you noticed traveling the world, other places, different interpretations of the style of music or different ways that people react to the music that you're playing? Or is it sort of uniform?
You mean the audience members?
Yeah. I both want to know how the audience members react, but also if you've, you've played jazz festivals in different parts of the world, if you've heard people from those places.
It's a great question for Dan, who actually gets to perform in more places than I do, and he could tell you more about the audience factor. From what I've noticed is that people in Europe and Asia tend to be more appreciative of this style of music. They in general, they love it. And Oh, I don't know. I really think I should defer to Dan on this.
Well, there's an exotic factor, you know, when we perform in I just did a concert in Berlin, Germany last week. I flew over. That's why I got sick, actually. I flew over, arrived on Tuesday, slept for a few hours, played the concert, flew home. Wow. Why do they, you know, there are plenty of clarinetists in Germany. Why do they bring an American over there to do this? Well, we were doing a Benny Goodman tribute. And, you know, I guess it's one thing to do a Benny Goodman tribute with all Germans. But when you actually have a real honest-to-God American in the band, it lends an air of authenticity to it. So you have two factors at work there, the authenticity, which is very important with this particular band. I should mention it. The band is the Swing Dance Orchestra, led by Andre Hermlin. It's Andre, A-N-D-R-E-J, Hermlin. And he's led this band for about 15 years. And he's all about authenticity. And so they play the arrangements very well. But having me in the band, I guess because of my connection to the United States and living in New York and my history playing the music of Benny Goodman, it gives it something special and exotic as well.
Yeah.
Just as when we have musicians from overseas perform here, when Max Raba, for example, performs at Carnegie Hall, he can sell the place out, you know, the German singer and bandleader. We couldn't do that with a Benny Goodman tribute here. Benny Goodman did it in 1938, but in 2016, we wouldn't be able to sell out Carnegie Hall with a tribute to Benny Goodman. They did fairly well a few years ago on the 75th anniversary, but they didn't do an authentic reproduction of the Carnegie Hall concert. They spiced it up with dancers and all kinds of effects. It's very hard to make it interesting both to the people who remember the music or perhaps remember their parents listening to the music. That is to say, the older folks, the people over 60, over 70, really.
Yeah.
And at the same time, to the younger generation. And right now, there's a whole resurgence in New York City of young people who are interested in the music of the 1920s, the Boardwalk Empire scene, which is very, very prevalent right now in New York City. But in order to bring people in to a venue, you can't rely entirely on just one generation. You got to attract the young people. And the hardest people to get in there are the ones that are sort of in the middle, the ones who have jobs and families they have to support, and their kids have soccer games, and you know they can't get away. So the young people don't have that yet, and the older people are retired, and the kids have moved away. So when we go to Germany, when I go to Germany, we're able to fill a 2,000-seat concert hall. There is a tremendous amount of appreciation, not just among older people, but people of all generations, it seems, for that music, which we don't find here. Young people don't want to sit down and listen to a 2 or 2.5 hour concert. They want to move around, they want to drink, they want to dance. The events that we have here that cater to the young people are geared towards that, and the fact is it's not a sit-down audience.
Yeah.
There are swing dancers, there are... they have shows within the shows. They have burlesque dancers. They have one event has a fire eater. that's the type of thing. It's a whole experience, and a lot of it is the visual aspect comes into play. People dress up to go to these events. They dress up in vintage clothing, like the Jazz Age Lawn Party.
Yeah.
One big event here. Shanghai Mermaid is another event. One I'm doing on Monday, this coming Monday, October 31st, is the 4th annual Halloween Stomp, which has it caters to the swing dancers. There are burlesque dancers. There are swing DJs. There are rooms that are decorated with various Halloween-themed decorations. It's a whole experience. It's on three floors of the DL, which is on Delancey Street. So, you know, that...
That sounds like a good time.
You have to... It is, you know, in order to get the audiences, the younger people, you have to give them a whole experience. It's really hard to make that happen if they have to sit down for 2 hours and just listen.
Yeah.
So that was a long answer to your question.
No, that's good, because it actually touched on something that I wanted to ask both of you, which is something that I've noticed. You talked about sort of multi-generational audiences, but I've noticed whenever I go to see jazz shows, especially swing music, there's not that much of it in Vancouver, at least that I know of, but there's some. But when I've seen it, the band members are generally, or a lot of the time, are of totally different ages. It's a very multi-generational music scene. It feels like you still have some of the, you know, less and less. Well, actually, if you could answer that, if it does feel multi-generational, and if there is, if that's just my misperception. And if it is, how do you think that influences the evolution of the sound?
I haven't been to Vancouver since 1979, so I may not be the one to judge about the scene. But you're speaking about New York, I assume, in terms of the generational aspect of the bands. I can't speak. I've been around, you know, I've seen different the different demographics in different regions. However, it always seems to originate here in New York, and then it sort of spreads out like a big swing dance craze, which was not really swing of the mid-90s. It was more jump blues. That started here, and I was part of that scene. And then it, like a ripple effect, it expanded to the point where there were swing dances all over the world. But by the time that had happened, it had died out here. And then it started to come back, but it always seems to be the epicenter, at least from my perception. And maybe that's I don't mean to be egotistical about New York. I'm not even from New York, so that's just my observation. But to answer your question, I saw something happen in about 10 years ago in 2006. It's kind of the year that I. Associate with this. When I, to backtrack a bit, when I first got into this music in the late 80s, started playing this music professionally, I was always the youngest member of the band by a long shot. I mean, most of the guys in the band could have been my grandfather. And in fact, people would often say, oh, you know, is one of these guys your grandfather? And it was that way for a long time. It became more like they were my father's age. But everyone was always older, and there didn't seem to be anybody else my age, this is in the late 80s again, who was into the jazz of the 1920s and 30s. I met a few, just a handful of people, and only one in New York that I can think of, John Eric Kelso, who's a year older than I am. But nobody else here, few in New Orleans. And I just accepted that that was the way it was. Most of these guys were left over from the 1940s and 50s revival of so-called Dixieland music. We don't even use that term anymore. It's not PC. But these guys heard the music growing up and played it growing up. Most of them were amateur musicians and played this as a hobby. And that's what they did. So there was a restaurant in town called Cajun that catered to a lot of these amateur bands. And the festival scene, jazz festivals also, called them Weekend Warriors. The Weekend Warriors have day jobs, and on the weekends they go out and play these jazz festivals. And that was the scene. That was the scene here. It was the scene in California. I'm from California, so I'm familiar with that scene as well. And then suddenly, in 1996, the first thing that happened, I noticed Cajun Restaurant closed after being in business since, I think, since the 1970s. It was 2006. Yeah. 2006. Thank you, Molly. Cajun closed. And that was the one place that featured traditional jazz 7 nights a week. And on that night, one of the last nights they were open, I went to hear Kevin Dorn's band there, Molly and I did. And Molly had seen in the Village Voice a, Craigslist. Hey, I'm glad you're here. On Craigslist, Jim, let me say, Dixieland Jam Session, right? In the East Village. And, you know, I thought I knew everybody in town. First of all, there's nothing going on in the East Village, so that was surprising. But we, Kevin Dorn, who was 10 years younger than I am, told him about this, and Jesse Gelber on piano. And we said, let's go. Let's see who these guys are. We go into the place in the East Village. Now, this is July 2006. And a bunch of young guys in their 20s. And we didn't know any of them. And they were playing from fake books, reading lead sheets, but they were playing traditional jazz. And I'd never seen anything like this before. It really was, especially to happen on the same night as one of the last nights the Cajun restaurant was open. Go over there and see a whole new generation of musicians playing this music. One of them turned out to be Dennis Lichtman, who you may know, who leads the band on Tuesday nights at Mona's, as since 2007, I think, the famous jam session hang, after hours hang from 11 p.m. till 3 in the morning. And Dennis was the clarinet player. I didn't know him at that time, but we sat in, Jesse Gelber and Kevin Dorn and Molly and I, sat in with the band, introduced ourselves, and that was the beginning of a real turnaround. I remember around the same time, we live on Washington Square, Molly came upstairs and she said, there's a band, a trio, playing in the park, and they're playing traditional jazz, young guys. And I went down, sure enough, three young guys playing in the park. So we saw it happen. We didn't realize that it was the beginning of a whole new trend. And around the same time, the guys had been playing the music since the 40s and 50s, retired. Many of them passed away. And what happened was, to take their place was that a whole new scene of young people discovering this music for the first time appeared in their place almost overnight. It happened over a few years, but it was maybe by 2 years or 3 years after that, I became the youngest member of every band I played in. And I'm still, oldest. Thank you, Molly. You knew what I meant. The oldest member. I went from being the youngest member to being the oldest member of every band. I'm still the oldest member of every band I play in. And it's a very strange thing. These musicians are, many of them are very talented. Some of them gone to music schools. Some, keeping in mind that the older guys they replaced, many of them amateurs, never went to music school and just did music as a hobby. But these guys are really intent on doing it as a profession. So it's great not only to be playing with a new generation of young musicians, but also so many talented young musicians that take it very seriously. The important thing is always, you know, to listen to the original recordings, if possible, rather than learning songs from the recordings, but from the sheet music and the recordings, if there's a historic recording.
Yeah.
To different extents, some of them take it very seriously and really go back and try to find the original recordings rather than learning them from other contemporary bands playing them, because by now the bands that have learned them from other bands have learned them from other bands, and by that time that happens, you often hear very little of what was originally part of the song. You're hearing somebody doing an interpretation of somebody else doing an interpretation of Billie Holiday, for example.
Yeah.
So it's always good, you know, and I have a lot of respect for the guys that care enough to go back and check it out. But it's great for me to be part of the scene. I'm sort of on the periphery, you know, that young guys like to work with young guys, but I'm on the list, you know, I'm on the sub list, and I'm working just about every night, and again, mostly with bands of musicians younger than I am. It's a beautiful thing to see come around again and to see everybody with the same enthusiasm that I had when I first heard this music, and I was about 17 years old, 16, 17, and I couldn't find anybody else to share it with. Nobody else was into it. And now there's a whole other aspect, which is tied in with that visual aspect and that experience I mentioned earlier, which is that it's trendy. So it's not just that the music is good, but it's part of a whole trend, and Boardwalk Empire helped that a lot.
Yeah.
So you get the idea. It's a real happening scene right now in New York City.
Well, that's great to hear. I wanted to ask about, you talked a lot about the younger generation sort of playing with them, but I wanted to ask about, so on Molly's last album, it features the pianist Dick Hyman, who, if I'm not mistaken, played with Benny Goodman. So that's...
Everybody. He's a god. He is a god. He's a legend. He's 89. He's 87 when he did that. Go ahead and ask your question, though. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, well, thank you for filling that in, because I did read that he also played with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, so he was all around, not only with...
Go ahead.
But I just wanted to ask Molly and you, Dan, because you were both involved, or you were also involved in the production of that album, played on it. What was it like playing with Dick Hyman, you know, sort of an elder statesman?
To say the least. I'll pass the phone over to Molly because I've talked enough in a minute. But Dick was, to say that he, you know, played with Benny Goodman, that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's played with everybody. He was born in 1927 and got his start in the 40s. I mean, I think he, one of the first things he did, he got won a scholarship, one first prize in a piano competition. First prize was 10 lessons with Teddy Wilson. And that was about 1945. He played with Benny in 1950. And the Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie thing, he's on the only sound recording of Charlie Parker that is in existence. It's Dick Hyman on piano, because he used to sub at Birdland for Bud Powell. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's just on Molly's album. Guy we just saw perform in July, and I saw him in August again, and is playing as good as ever at 89, was around the scene in the 1940s and 50s to think, you know, he's a living legend.
I
got out of college in 1987 and didn't know what I was going to do, and I was very fortunate through a friend and a great pianist named Max Morath, who just turned 90. Max, I knew Max, and I was visiting him one day, and he said, you know, Dick Hyman lives upstairs, and I think he's looking for a personal assistant. Is that something you'd be interested in? It was April 1987. I was due to graduate in May, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I interviewed, I got the job, and for the next 6 years, while I was getting my chops together, learning, meeting people and learning my instruments, I was working as Dick Hyman's assistant.
Wow.
So I met a lot of the people through him that I'm now working with. Vince Giordano, for example, who I've been in Vince's band for over 23 years with Vince Giordano's Nighthawks. I met Vince through Dick Hyman, through his Jazz in July series at the 92nd Street Y here in Manhattan. Vince's band performed there, and I was working as his assistant. So that's that opened the door for me, and not to mention, forgetting about how great a musician Dick Hyman is, which you can't forget about. If you believe me when I tell you, he is as great a businessman as he is a musician. We all know how great a musician he is, but he really has it all together.
Wow.
One in a million. He taught me not just about music, but about the business of music. It's something I wish more people coming up understood, because the key to success is being a great musician and being a great businessman, and he had he has it all. So I learned that from him. And when we were jumping forward to 2014, when we were getting the album together, we had had Bucky Pizzarelli on her previous album, and we were talking about who we could get for this album, and I thought Dick Hyman would be a great choice. It's our baby sneezing. Bless you. So I suggested that to Molly, and I think she'll pick up the thread here.
Well, I always let Dan Dan's full of a lot of information.
Too much information.
And good stories, so it's better if he talks.
Well, but so I suggested Dick to Molly, and you said.
Yeah, I kind of think it was my idea, but it's all right. I'll let you have the.
All right, it was Molly's idea.
I'll let you have the credit on
it. No, it was your idea.
That's okay. It's really okay.
It was her idea, and I said, you know, I think I could make contact with him and ask him, right?
Yeah, that's kind of how it
was. That's how it happened.
Yeah.
And that's our story, and we're sticking to it.
Okay.
Well, so, yeah, but to have him in the studio, and Molly can, I hope Molly will interject here, but I like to quote the recording engineer who, by the way, is a brilliant man, a brilliant engineer, a great person, Stuart Lerman, who was the engineer in all the Boardwalk Empire sessions, so which I did with Vince Giordano's Nighthawk. So I had met Stuart. He won a Grammy for his work on Boardwalk Empire. He's that good. And we wanted the best engineer in the business, and I contacted Stu. So I like to quote Stu in reference to Dick Hyman. After Hyman had played a solo, I went into the engineer's booth to listen back to it, and Stu said, "I feel like I've been to the mountain."
Oh, wow.
It really was like being in the presence of such a giant, a guru, a legend, a god. His solo on Let's Fly Away, I think it's like a symphonic work. And I wrote, it's actually Dan Barrett's arrangement. But Hyman made a piano solo of it. I guess Barrett had said,
we were talking about whether or not I was going to sing the verse,
yeah.
And the verse was written out, but I hadn't ever sung it before. And while Dan Barrett and I were talking about it, we heard Dick Hyman over in the corner kind of noodling away. And Dan and I looked over there, and we heard what he was doing. And I looked back at Dan, and we both said at the same time, let's let Dick have this.
Yeah, so we gave him the verse, which was one of the best decisions we ever made.
Gave him the verse, and the verse, the lyrics are kind of morbid anyway. And we're doing a take, and we do take one, and it's fantastic. And Dick says, let's do that again, and then we do it again. And second one was different, but equally as fantastic. And then he says, I want to do it again. And then in everyone's cans, you hear Dick say, all right, everyone, I'm going to get a little extravagant now. And it was this magnificent moment where he just does his thing,
yeah,
and
you let loose.
Creates magic.
But all of them, all the takes were
wow.
Great. And in Randy Reinhardt, who was playing trumpet, pointed out that we heard him working it out before we did it, our first take. We heard him working out what he was going to play. And what he ended up playing on the first take didn't seem to have any resemblance to what he had worked out during his own preparation for it. So, and then on the second take, he did something completely different. And then the third take, the one where he said, I'm going to get a little extravagant, that's the symphony. And that's the one where Stu said, I feel like I've been to the mountain.
Yeah.
So just every moment in the studio was just a treasured moment to be in the presence of such a giant.
And he's so youthful. He's 89. He was 87 when he did the recording, and he really seemed more young and fit than anyone else in the studio. And we all ordered lunch, and everyone's ordering burgers. And I look over, and what'd you order, Dick? Oh, I just got some oatmeal.
Yeah. Well, he's always taking very good care of himself.
He's very healthy.
Yeah, you know, he never indulges to excess in anything. He does everything right. He and his wife have been married, I think, almost 65 years or something. They met when they were 16 years old. He's done everything right his whole life.
Jeez. Well, that's those are some great stories, and it sounds like a great experience to play and learn from a living legend.
Yep.
I also wanted to ask to both of you what it's like playing music with each other and working on each other's music and bands and so on. You know, since your husband and wife, what's that experience like? As opposed, I guess it's kind of hard to answer just like that, but as opposed, I guess, to playing with other people.
Well, our experience is definitely different than everyone else's experience. So I know how I feel about it, but I wouldn't go on our experience to get your information about anyone else who's a husband and wife duo.
Oh, no, I just want to know about the two of you.
Well, I don't know about Dan, but I get a lot of pleasure performing with Dan's group, and whenever we have the opportunity to perform together, it's always pretty special, and I don't know if we make each other better, but he definitely has made me a better vocalist by being able to listen to him and see the way that he leads his bands and directs and talks to an audience. Just the experience of being in a band with him is a learning experience for me. And it doesn't ever stop. I've been performing with him for 13 years now, and I'm still learning from him. Every time we get on a stage, there's something that he does, and I say, oh, yeah, that was a good call. I'll have to remember that he did that, or that he said that, or that he played that. And he's so organized that he's taught me how to be organized, and I'm a better band leader because I go into things more prepared, still not as prepared as I should be, and still not as prepared as he is, but I realize how much preparation is necessary, and I try to show up to things and with everything in its place and to be reliable, because that's one thing you really need to be when you're a freelance artist, is reliable, above anything else, reliable.
Yeah. I'll chime in there a little bit. You still with us?
Yeah.
Oh, you're speechless.
Well, you both left me speechless. That was a great answer, Molly. Thank you. So I'd like to hear you as well, Dan.
Yeah, when I first started out, I actually wanted to be a singer before I started playing clarinet and saxophone, since I was very young. And it took me many, many years to realize that I wasn't a good singer, even without laryngitis. I just didn't have, some people just have a good voice. And I really wanted to believe I could be that person. I took lessons for years and years and years. Some people just don't have it. But when I heard Molly, she sings the melody the way I like to hear it sung. She's very faithful to the original composition. She spends the time to learn the melody. She doesn't learn it from a Billie Holiday record. And this is not a jab at Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday was great, but we all know that she often, in fact, most of the time, didn't sing the melody. A lot of people are learning these tunes from hearing her records. Molly would go back and listen to other versions also, like big band vocalists notoriously would sing the melody because that's what their job was. Helen Ward with Benny Goodman, all the Helens, Helen Forrest with Artie Shaw, Helen Humes, Helen O'Connell with Jimmy Dorsey, Martha Tilton with Benny Goodman, their job was to sing the melodies. So Molly listened to a lot of those, and I really enjoyed when she sang a song because I got to hear the actual song. And I'm a real, needless to say, I have a real appreciation for not just jazz, but the songs, the composers and the lyricists that created the music the jazz musicians have played all these years. When I heard her sing, it was like hearing an angel sing the very first time. That's the way I wanted it. And that was before I had had any influence on her at all. So she started with all the right tools. And I made her some CDs of singers that I liked, who naturally adhered to the original composition, the melodies, like Al Boley. It was, Mrs. Mullen says, that was a long time ago. Al Boley with Ray Noble and the big band singers I just mentioned. Early Frank Sinatra did that. Margaret Whiting. Oh, yeah. Maxine Sullivan. And she absorbed all of this, and she took all of this in and created something, a synthesis of all of these different influences, and created Molly Ryan from that. So when I hear Molly sing, it's the way I would sing if I could sing, if I had the talent that she does. So there's that aspect of it, the whole musical aspect. And then there's the love, which is a whole other thing. It is complicated when you're married to someone. It's not like Sonny and Cher. I mean, a lot of that was they played up the whole marriage thing, and we do that sometimes too because people get a kick out of it. But there's a really great camaraderie and a collaboration involved in the whole process of doing this. We help each other. She helps me, and I help her. And I like to think that, I should say this, I've helped her a lot, and I've influenced her, but she's been just as much of an influence on me. And, if it weren't for her, you'd think that this whole turnaround happened in 1996 and that I'm still the youngest member of the band. She keeps an eye on me. And now that I'm getting on in years, it's very important to have also my connection with the younger generation is founded on the fact that she is younger than I am, and she's involved in this whole scene.
Yeah, but they love you.
Well,
they all love you.
I don't know. I'm happy to be part of it, happy to be part of the whole scene. And Molly came into the picture just before that happened. She moved here in 2003. So she was already, we had the whole system in place, ready, poised, and waiting for the turnaround that happened a few years later.
That's good that it all worked out. And it's very nice to hear your side as well of what it's like playing together. And I guess you've both alluded to this a little bit throughout the interview, but one thing that I noticed listening to the Let's Fly Away record and some of the other stuff that I could find on Bandcamp was that Molly's music definitely, and also in the way that you sing, which I there's a definite sense of joy in the music, at least that's what I got from it, and it's also that's in a lot of the original recordings, just in the style of that kind of music, which is what drew me to it. What was my interest in it, I think, stems from is that there's a sense of joy in a lot of the original recordings, but that's hard to keep up, and it's hard to, I guess, reproduce. And from what both of you have said about playing with each other, playing, for example, with Dick Hyman and other people, is that the playing together can be a bit of a joyous experience, and I guess that gets passed as reproduced in the music. I just wanted to... I didn't really have a question, but, does the joy that... you know, me as a audience member or someone listening to the record that I hear, does that come from the interplay with the musicians, or is it from, I guess, a faithfulness to to the songs and the melodies that have that aspect. And obviously not all of it, because there's, you know, there's ballads and romantic songs, I guess. But yeah, I just need to stop at a certain point. So if either of you could chime in about...
Well, you know, not every performance or every recorded song that we do is going to have that happiness and that joy. It's a culmination of the fact that we love these songs so much. We love the music so much. And the players that we are having the opportunity to play with are just so phenomenal that you can't help but be inspired. And when you're inspired, you're happy and you're making happy music. And you also know that what you're doing, it's a project that you're passionate about. And you're so excited to be playing with the players and to know that there are people that are going to hear this, and I guess joy is a good word for it, but what it really is excitement. We get excited about our projects, and we get excited about the arrangements and who we're playing with, and being in the recording studio where we were. We were in a famous recording studio, Avatar and Seer Sound, both really well-renowned studios. Just every part of it brought us fulfillment. And I'm glad that it comes out in the music the way it does, because it's not always like that, but it definitely was in this case and for this recording. Dan has something to add.
Well, there's also the aspect of during the course of a performance, we are characters, we're actors in a play. And that's not to say that the joy isn't genuine. You know, my training, I'm embarrassed to say, was as an actor before I became a musician. But I feel a strong theatrical aspect in the music, mm-hmm. In the arrangements that I write. I would say that my arrangements, I wrote most of them for Let's Fly Away. Dan Barrett wrote five of them, I think. I wrote the others. But there is a strong dramatic aspect to that. And when we are performing those, now I can't speak for the other musicians, but I know that Molly, who also has training in theater, we're characters, and we try to recreate the sentiments, the emotions that are present in the music. And that's not true of every song on the album. And we have Traveling All Alone. That's certainly not a song about joy. Under Paris Skies, you know, it's about a broken heart. There are a lot of emotions. Obviously, Beyond the Blue Horizon has a happy aspect to it, and Wanderer. But and then the poignant, reflective quality of the very last number, which is Anywhere I Wander, from the Frank Lesser show, Hans Christian Andersen, Anywhere I Wander, which sort of takes you back home. So there are a lot of different emotions. I don't think it's just joy, but certainly in the more upbeat tunes, we're creating. I try to create that with the arrangements, and I know the musicians, whether they're feeling genuine joy or not during the performance, I don't know. But we surround ourselves with musicians who don't sound like miserable people when they play. You know, there is a truth to that. I've heard musicians that just sound angry all the time. They sound frustrated. They sound resentful. They're mad at the world. They're mad at the music business. And believe me, they have a right to be. After spending almost 30 years in the music business, I feel their pain. But the music is supposed to be not just about expressing your anger and resentment at the way the world has treated you, but expressing everything that's inside you. Oftentimes, getting back to Dick Hyman, and he told me about Charlie Parker. Somebody asked him about what was Charlie Parker like as a person, and Dick said, you know, I didn't find that he was very articulate when he spoke, but he was able to say everything in his music. And great musicians really have a way of doing that, running the gamut of emotions from anger to joy to sadness, longing, to a pathos that we can only get in the music. And it all comes down to that, really. We're expressing ourselves and what's inside ourselves. And the arrangement, the songs, the notes that the composer and lyrics, the composer wrote, the lyrics, even if they're not part of the solo, enter into my interpretation of a song, even though I'm thinking about the lyrics while I'm playing. So there are a lot of aspects that go into the performance, and I think that's a good answer to your question.
No, that was very good. I think you got touched it on it a bit. That's not just joy, of course, but there's definitely, both you and Molly, a sense of excitement and sort of respect and love for the music that comes through on all the numbers, all the different songs that are able to express the different emotions. Because as you said, with some musicians who are angry or resentful, that you can definitely hear that in the music. And I also feel like some of the music that I listen to, that it can be tiresome if the music feels indulgent. You know, if the musician is imbuing the music with too much of a sense of either self-pity or self-aggrandizement or, you know, just self, so
yeah,
that it takes away from it. Yeah.
Right.
And I feel like with what I've listened to, that's not the case, of course.
Right. Well, that's a subject I could go on for another hour about. But what you just talked about, the self-conscious aspect of music. And I find a lot of more modern jazz, it's more about the soloist than about the ensemble. And for me, the exciting part of music, of jazz, when I first started listening to it, and what drew me to the earlier jazz rather than to later jazz, was the interaction, the ensembles. And the solos tend to be shorter, and the performances in general are shorter.
That's why we started the jazz camp.
Molly said that's why I started the jazz camp. I always really enjoyed the interaction. It's less about being self-conscious, and more about making the entire ensemble sound good. And my favorite musicians are the ones who make everybody else sound good. Dick Hyman does that. Randy Reinhardt does that. Dan Barrett does that in a big way. He always makes me play better, not just by inspiring me in the way I play, but just in terms of thinking about what he can do while I'm taking a solo to make me sound better. Sometimes if it's on a bandstand where we don't have an arrangement, sometimes it's just about playing a riff behind me or some notes. But if he's writing an arrangement, if Dan Barrett is a great arranger, he'll write an arrangement that he'll write something around the soloist to make the soloist sound better. And that to me is the whole essence of music, is that you're not just there to sound good, you're there to help everybody else sound as good as they possibly can.
Tune in every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. for A Little Bit of Soul with your host, Jade Park. A Little Bit of Soul plays primarily old recordings of jazz, swing, big band, blues, oldies, and Motown.
Do you have no direction? Are you trying to make sense of this absurd existence that we experience on a daily basis?
Do you wish to find meaning in this existential quagmire that is the daily grind?
Well, come on down to CITR for Volunteer Wednesdays from 11 to 1 p.m. every week and find your meaning in life. No experience is necessary. So what are you waiting for, Sisyphus? Life is knocking.
All right, that was part one of my interview with Dan Levinson and Molly Ryan, two New York City jazz musicians that I had the pleasure of meeting and talking to. Next week, we will have part two of the interview where we talk a little bit about Benny Goodman, about Django Reinhardt, Leon Redbone, about, about a lot. It's good. I hope you enjoyed it this week. I was pleasantly met in the studio a few minutes ago by MC Shay McConkey. She is the host of the now defunct Shine On. Great show, great host. She is also the co-president of the student executive. So Her Majesty, as she likes the rest of people, everyone at CITR to call her. How are you, Your Majesty?
Well, thank you for that wonderful intro. I don't know if I can live up to it now, though. That was very high standard.
I know. I thought I was being nice, but I might have accidentally been mean.
Just crossed the line a little bit.
I went too far.
Just a little bit.
Stupid Eric.
I don't think I'm as mean as Eric kind of made me seem.
No, Shay is a beautiful person inside and out.
Oh,
no, that's true.
Thanks.
Yeah, what was I going to say? Tim, Russian Tim, who has the show on after my show, Rocket from Russia, is at a punk rock festival, so his show will not be happening this week. That's why we're going a little bit over and just, you know, enjoying ourselves. Shay, what Halloween's coming up.
Why are you throwing things at me?
That was accidental. I just want to be president again.
It's over, man.
Let go.
Accept it.
What's your Halloween costume, Shay?
I'm going as Kurt Cobain, the one and only.
Nice.
If you know him.
Yeah. Yeah. Singer-songwriter.
Kind of folky.
Yeah.
I have pink hair, as you know. I've had pink hair like this whole school term. And my friend Madeline, that you know,
yeah,
has like, you know, the long blonde hair. And it was her idea to go as Courtney and for me to go as Kurt. And I was just like, yes, I'm so into it.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Great couples costume.
Totally.
And also they're both a little scary.
Yeah.
Halloween totally appropriate.
We should I think we're going to try to really spruce up the heroin chic-ness
of the
look.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, you got to play it up.
Yeah.
And,
get her makeup all smudged and
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's sick.
It's going to be fun. I love Halloween.
And what are you going to be doing tomorrow night?
I'm going to be...
Because, Halloween's on Monday.
It's true. Yeah, it's always... It's
or
always
is it
a little
on
weird.
Sunday?
No, it's on Monday.
It's on Monday.
It's always a little weird when Halloween's not on a weekend, not on a Friday or Saturday. Because, for me at this age, the actual Halloween day doesn't, really matter to me. It's not like I'm going to, dress up on the day and come to school. It's just a normal Monday. Maybe some people will, and I applaud them, but yeah, for me, I don't really care that much. I care more about the going out to see everyone else's costumes and the party side of it is fun.
Although it's always fun on Halloween to see the little kids who dress up.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, when we were discussing costume ideas, said that I should be a painter. just like a painter. And at first, I was like, "That's just, mom, I'm not 8 years old. I don't need to be a painter." And my mom was like, "Eric, you should be a painter. You'd be beautiful as a painter. You don't have any other costumes. What are you going to do? What are you going to try and be an alien?" It's ridiculous. A vampire? And I was like, "Mom, those are all like children's costumes. I can't be a painter." And then 10 minutes later, I was like, "You know what? Painter's actually like a pretty solid costume idea." I honestly think, well, I think we're both going to go to the Redgate cover show tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If I showed up as just a painter, period, not like a specific painter, not like Picasso or Frida Kahlo or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, or Edvard Munch.
Yeah.
But just like painter.
Right.
I think that would actually be very funny.
That's pretty good. What would you wear? Just like a painter's smock?
Yeah, basically.
And just try to look as generic as possible?
Yeah.
Would you
wear like maybe like canvas pants, the smock.
You wouldn't go for like the French stereotype painter.
No, I'd maybe wear a beret and I'd carry around easel?
No.
That's not an easel. The palette?
The palette, yeah.
Yeah, with some paint and a paintbrush.
Yeah.
Maybe just leave my mustache.
Were you going to say paint on a mustache?
I was going to paint on. I had a debate with my mom. And my mom was like, "Yeah, just leave your mustache, honey." And I was like, "No, paint on a mustache." And she was like, no, that's ridiculous. You have facial hair. You have too much facial hair. Just use the mustache." And I was like, "No, but if I paint it on, I'll be sick." And then my mom was like, "Eric." And I was like, "Okay, you're right." So
I just want to interject and say that your mother does not sound anything like that. Your mom has the most lovely voice. But I really love your impression. It makes me laugh every time.
Yeah,
it's
well,
so funny.
You know, the beauty.
It's gold.
Thank you, Shay. Yeah, no, my mom hates it when I do that. She honestly sometimes is just like, "Why do you make me sound like that to your friends?"
It's so funny, too, because it's like every voice ever that you portray is that voice.
Yeah, so imitation of...
Female, anyway.
No, like male,
actually,
too.
Actually, male, too, yeah.
When right. I try and do like Marv Albert or Kevin Harlan, like basketball presenters or commentators, and
can
it's
I,
like...
Can I hear a preview?
Yeah, something like... "Oh, he's cooking with some hot butter." And I'm like, "My goodness, throws down the jam." And I'm like, "Kevin Durant with another from downtown." It's like pretty much the same voice. Like,
yeah.
I could do my mom just being like, "Oh my God, Eric with another miss from the 4-inch line. Good job, honey. I love you. Come here for some oranges." That'd be her commentary.
Your poor mother.
I know she's like the only person listening to this right now.
Totally. I think you have a lovely voice, Eric's mom.
I do too. Yeah, anyways, we got sidetracked here. The show, we're lucky we had the interview. Dan Levinson, Molly Ryan, please check in again next week. I'm going to be podcasting this soon. And I guess that's about it for the show. We've overstayed our welcome. Thank you so much, Shay, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, as always.
It was a pleasure. You're welcome anytime you like. You know, you can bring in songs. You know, like just chat.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You good overall? Everything solid? Did you give blood?
I did not give blood. Blood got taken from me. I put up a good fight, but it didn't work out this time.
What happened?
Oh, yeah, I just got some blood taken, making sure that my physiological self is all healthy.
And, oh, good.
Yeah, yeah.
And when do you find out?
I have another doctor's appointment next week, so I'll find out then.
Well, you come back on the show and fill us in.
I'll give you an update, make sure that I'm not dying.
Well, yeah, don't. So.
I'm just kidding. I'm not. Like, I'm not anywhere close to dying.
Thank you.
Great. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, totally. I'm just dark.
I get you're getting in the Kurt Cobain headspace.
I'm just trying to get there.
Okay.
It's all about the character.
Yeah, that's a method actress Shay McConkey on the show today.
You're welcome.
Inside the actor's studio with Shay McConkey. You'll be portraying Kurt Cobain in a new biopic from the Weinstein Company. Directed by Richard Linklater. Also starring Jenna Malone. Please, how did you get into character?
Amazing. I got compared to Jenna Malone once.
I can kind of see it. It's like a slight resemblance.
I don't know her face. Like, I had to look her up to know what she looks like.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that would be your celebrity doppelganger.
No.
But I don't know. Yeah, so anyways, we've got next week, we've got Dan Levinson and Molly Ryan. And right now we're going to close out the show with some hot jazz from Vancouver. It's the Jen Hodge All-Stars with the song Viper Mad by Sidney Bechet from 1923. And it is off their album Guilty Pleasures. You can see Jen Hodge every Wednesday at Guilt & Company, I believe. Great swing jazz, old-timey music that you can dance to. It's really fun. You should go check it out. And enjoy. We'll be back next week. No rock from Russia this week. Thanks again to Dan and Molly for the interviews and to you, Shay, for coming on the show. Enjoy.
Get high with me. Good tea's my weakness. bad. Incense began.